Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Anna Mateo and Steve Ember. But first, Dorothy Gundy brings us this report with help from Ann Ball.
Lists that rate colleges and universities are very popular among parents and students in the United States. But are published lists the best way to choose the right school? The best-known ranking is probably by the magazine U.S. News and World Report. On top of the magazine's list this year are schools known around the world. They include Princeton University in New Jersey, Harvard University in Massachusetts, Columbia University in New York City, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, in Boston, the University of Chicago, and Yale University in Connecticut. U.S. News and World Report published its first America's Best Colleges report in 1983. Since then, some educators have questioned the published rankings and how useful they are.
A number of magazines publish lists of college rankings once every year. High school students use the lists as reference guides when considering where to continue their education. There are plenty of schools to choose from. Across the country, more than 4,000 colleges and universities offer undergraduate degree programs. Last month, Forbes published its college ratings for 2019. It listed 650 schools. That represents only about 15% of all U.S. institutions of higher learning. The magazine's top five are a little different from those of U.S. News and World Report. They are Harvard University, Stanford University in California, Yale University, MIT, and Princeton University. Like other lists, Forbes considers things like student satisfaction, how successful college graduates are, and how much money they make. The magazine adds another important piece of information: how much debt students will owe after they graduate.
We spoke with education experts and people whose job it is to help high school students choose the right college. All of them said students and parents should look at more than just rankings because they do not tell the whole story about a school. Ray Anderson of Virginia is a former high school principal. He now works with a service called AGM College Advisors. It provides guidance on higher education to students and their families. Anderson says what is most important to him is knowing what the student wants, likes, and is capable of doing. The focus is on who you are and then what schools match you, Anderson said, not matching you to the school. Anderson told VOA the published rankings can help because they have valuable information about the schools.
Jeffrey Stahl agrees that rankings have limited value. In his job as a counselor at Yorktown High School in Virginia, he talks with students about colleges. Stahl says choosing a college is a very personal decision. He said that the rankings can be helpful, but some students place too much attention on the name of a school and its position in rankings. So much about the campus environment, students, professors, cannot be shown just by ranking, Stahl said. He suggests that families use the ranking information as a starting point. Then they should widen their search, make their own list, and go see the colleges for themselves.
But David Hawkins is critical of the college rankings. He is with the National Association for College Admission Counseling. He told VOA that rankings are not mathematically proven to measure the quality of any single college, much less to provide comparisons between colleges. Hawkins said lower-ranked schools may have difficulty getting students interested in their programs. As such, he said, the rankings have been known to create ethical problems as institutions misreport data or otherwise seek to manipulate their ranking. Like the other experts we spoke with, he said students must look past those ratings to gain a more factual opinion about the schools for themselves.
In July, U.S. News and World Report deranked 5 institutions from its list for misreporting information. Because of this, the magazine said, their ranking number was higher than they otherwise would have been. The 5 included the well-known University of California at Berkeley. Hawkins noted that people overseas might think the rankings come from the U.S. government. That is not true, he notes. We try to emphasize that these are commercial publications rather than official rankings of any sort. Richard DeMillo heads the Center for 21st Century Universities at the Georgia Institute of Technology. He also is a professor at Georgia Tech, a school that moved up 13 positions on Forbes' latest list.
DeMillo says while the higher rank is nice, it does not matter. He believes that Forbes, U.S. News and World Report, and other publications are providing a service if you ignore the ranking part of it. For example, he finds the information about all the study programs to be useful. The ratings sometimes list lesser-known schools that might be strong in a field of study that a student is interested in. All the experts VOA spoke with had similar advice for students looking for the right college. Go visit the school, talk to the admissions officers, and talk with current students. There are so many hidden gems out there, Jeffrey Stahl said. Just because a college doesn't make the list doesn't mean it doesn't have great programs and resources. I'm Ann Ball.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Now, the VOA Learning English Program, Words and Their Stories. The fruit of apple trees is a popular food in many countries. Some word experts say that no other fruit is used in more English language expressions than the apple. For example, you can be the apple of someone's eye, meaning the most loved. You can upset the apple cart, meaning to create disorder. If your apple didn't fall far from the tree, you are very much like your mom or dad. And if you compare apples and oranges, you are comparing two things that are so different that any comparison is really not productive. And today we have yet another apple term. That term is apple polisher. To explain it, we need to go back to school. In the United States, people have long used the apple as a sign or symbol for education. Teachers and school officials often use apples in announcements and on posters hung in classrooms and school hallways. Candidates for school board positions often put an apple on election campaign materials. And many makers of school supplies put images of apples on their products. But why is the apple a symbol of education? Some historians say this tradition began in the 1800s when settlers were moving to what is now the Western United States. Back then, the U.S. government did not provide money for schools in the Western frontier. The early settlers were responsible for making the schoolhouses and operating them. They also had to provide housing and food for the teachers. Students would bring teachers food from family farms. This would often include potatoes, vegetables, and apples. Apples were a fairly common form of payment since they grew easily in many different climates, and they were used to make apple cider, a popular drink. Over the years, the tradition of giving food, in this case apples, as payment changed. It became a way of welcoming a teacher on the first day of class, and, hopefully, leaving a good impression. Americans looked at apples as not only sweet and tasty, but really healthy. They are also colorful, more so than potatoes. So they make a better gift. So that is how apples became popular gifts for teachers. And giving apples to teachers became a way of trying to curry favor with them. To curry someone's favor means you try to win them over by giving them something. You know, if you often give your teacher an apple, he or she may look kindly on you when they grade your next test. And if that apple is a beautiful, shiny one, well, your chances of getting better treatment is increased. And that is where the term apple polisher comes in. Not only does an apple polisher bring in an apple to get better treatment from the teacher, they also keep it nice and shiny. This makes sure it will be the most beautiful apple on the teacher's desk. The singers Bing Crosby and Connie Boswell sang about this in the 1930 song, Apple for the Teacher.
An apple for the teacher is always going to do the trick.
Not if you didn't study your
arithmetic. I got an apple for the teacher. We're gonna meet with great success.
Well, it won't if you didn't memorize the Gettysburg Address.
We use this as a noun and a verb. When you apple polish, you use gifts or say nice things to improve your situation. We have other words that mean the same thing. We also call this type of person a kiss-up, toady, or bootlicker. Another popular one is teacher's pet. It is an apple polisher's dream to become the teacher's pet, much to the anger of fellow classmates. Whether in school or at work, apple polishers often anger those around them. And that brings us to the end of this Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
Today on Making of a Nation, we tell about relations between the American colonies and Britain following the French and Indian War. Here is Steve Ember.
The French and Indian War was one part of a world conflict between Britain and France. It was fought to decide which of the two powerful nations would control North America. The British defeated the French in North America in 1763. As a result, the British took control of lands that had been claimed by France. Britain was now responsible for almost 2 million people in the 13 American colonies and 60,000 French-speaking people in Canada. In addition to political and economic responsibilities, Britain had to protect all these colonists from different groups of Indians. This would cost a lot of money. Britain already had spent a lot sending troops and material to the colonies to fight the French and Indian War. It believed the American colonists should now help pay for that war. The colonists in North America in 1763 were very different from those who had settled there more than 100 years before. They had different ideas. They had come to consider their colonial legislatures as smaller but similar to the British Parliament in London. These smaller parliaments had helped the colonists rule themselves for more than 100 years. The colonists began to feel that their legislatures should also have the powers that the British Parliament had. The situation in England had changed as well. In the year 1707, the nation became officially known as Great Britain. Its king no longer controlled Parliament as he had in the early 1600s. Then the king decided all major questions, especially those concerning the colonies. But power had moved from the king to the Parliament. It was the legislature that decided major questions by the time of the French and Indian War, especially the power to tax. The parliaments in the colonies began to believe that they too should have this power of taxation. The first English settlers in America considered themselves citizens of England. They had made a dangerous trip across the ocean to create a little England in a new place, to trade with the mother country, and to spread their religion. By 1763, however, the colonists thought of themselves as Americans. Many of their families had been in North America for 50 to 100 years. They had cleared the land, built homes, fought Indians, and made lives for themselves far away from Britain. They had different everyday concerns than the people in Britain. Their way of life was different, too. They did not want anyone else to tell them how to govern themselves. The people in Britain, however, still believed that the purpose of a colony was to serve the mother country. The government treated British citizens in the colonies differently from those at home. It demanded special taxes from the colonists. It also ordered them to feed British troops and let them live in their houses. Britain claimed that the soldiers were in the colonies to protect the people. But the people asked, "Protect us from whom?" As long as the French were nearby in Canada, the colonists needed the protection of the British Army and Navy. After the French were gone, following their defeat in the French and Indian War, the colonists felt they no longer needed British military protection. The British government demanded that the colonists pay higher and higher taxes. One reason was that the government wanted to show the colonists that it was in control. Another reason was that Britain was having money problems. Foreign wars had left the country with big debts. The British thought the colonists should help pay some of these debts, especially those resulting from the French and Indian War. The American colonists might have agreed, but they wanted to have a say in the decision. They wanted the right to vote about their own taxes, like the people living in Britain. But no colonists were permitted to serve in the British Parliament, so they protested that they were being taxed without being represented. In 1764, the British Parliament approved the Sugar Act. This legislation set taxes on sugar, coffee, some wines, and other products imported to America in large amounts. It increased the taxes on European products sent to the colonies through Britain. The British government also approved new measures aimed at enforcing all trade laws. And it decided to restrict the production of paper money in the colonies. The American colonists opposed all these new laws. Yet they could not agree about how to resist. Colonial assemblies approved protests against the laws, but the protests were all different and had no real effect. Business groups attempted to organize boycotts of goods, but these were not very successful until the British government approved another tax in 1765, a tax on stamps. The Stamp Act probably angered more American colonists than any earlier tax. Under this law, the colonists had to buy a British stamp for every piece of printed paper they used. That meant they would be taxed for every piece of newspaper, every document, even every playing card. The colonists refused to pay. Colonial assemblies approved resolutions suggesting that the British Parliament had no right to tax the colonies at all. Some colonists were so angry that they attacked British stamp agents. Historians say the main reason the colonists were angry was because Britain had rejected the idea of no taxation without representation. Almost no colonist wanted to be independent of Britain at that time, yet all of them valued their rights as British citizens and the idea of local self-rule. They considered the Stamp Act to be the worst in a series of violations of these rights. The American colonists refused to obey the Stamp Act. They also refused to buy British goods. Almost 1,000 store owners signed non-importation agreements. This cost British businessmen so much money that they demanded that the government cancel the Stamp Act. Parliament finally canceled the law in 1766. The colonists immediately ended their ban on British goods. But the same day that Parliament ended the Stamp Act, it approved the Declaratory Act. This was a statement saying the colonies existed to serve Britain, and that Britain could approve any law it wanted. Many American colonists considered this statement to be illegal. Historians say this shows just how separated the colonies had become from Britain. Colonial assemblies were able to approve their own laws, but only with the permission of the British Parliament. The colonists, however, considered the work of their assemblies as their own form of self-rule. Britain canceled the Stamp Act, but did not stop demanding taxes. In 1767, Parliament approved a series of new taxes called the Townshend Acts. These were named after the government official who proposed them. The Townshend Acts set taxes on glass, tea, lead, paints, and paper imported into the colonies. The American colonists rejected the Townshend Acts and started a new boycott of British goods. They also took steps to increase manufacturing in the colonies. By the end of 1769, they had reduced by half the amount of goods imported from Britain. The colonies also began to communicate with each other about their problems. In 1768, the Massachusetts General Court sent a letter to the legislatures of the other colonies. It said the Townshend Acts violated the colonists' natural and constitutional rights. When news of the letter reached London, British officials ordered the colonial governor of Massachusetts to dismiss the legislature. Then they moved 4,000 British troops into Boston, the biggest city in Massachusetts and the biggest city in the American colonies. The people of Boston hated the British soldiers. The soldiers were controlling their streets and living in their houses. This tension led to violence.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.